From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Tariel Spinol.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
The Yorktown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, we go for a drive with both hands off the wheel.
We had one guy who decided to plug his laptop in by digging in the back, pulling out the power cord, pulling out the laptop, you know, all while moving down the freeway.
And we explore the legal and ethical issues when the driver is a computer.
When we have those fully automated vehicles, the manufacturer is going to have to take responsibility for all the things that the quote-unquote driver, the human, used to be responsible for.
Driverless cars, the future is here today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The more we modernize, the more we find ourselves relying on automated machines, elevators, vending machines, sliding doors. And here in Silicon Valley, where engineers like to take things to the next level, automated cars. Steve Henn from Planet Money and Katie Mingle from 99% Invisible teamed up to take one of those cars for a spin.
Earlier this summer, I took a ride in Google's self-driving car.
Pre-planned route.
Okay. We were driving through a construction site, and we were going past a guy holding one of those two-sided stop signs. It says slow on one side and stop on the other. And right as we went by, the guy flipped the sign around to read stop.
Temporary stop sign.
The Google car slammed on its brakes all by itself. Wow.
So that was quite interesting.
The car startled us. It stopped so quickly. None of us had seen that stop sign flip around when it happened.
I think I've blown through manual stop signs like that 1,000 times.
This car sees more than we do. It doesn't get distracted. And even though this is kind of a low bar, I'm convinced it is a better driver than I am already. But if a little drone car pulled up to my house tomorrow and there was no driver inside, no steering wheel, no brakes, would I put my children in it? The statistics, the research say this thing is safe, but it's still scary. Automation is all around us, and most of the time we never think about it. It makes our lives easier, it keeps us safe, but there is this moment when something new is introduced, when it first becomes automatic, that's disorienting. It freaks us out. I mean, basically, there are two ways to make someone really comfortable with a machine. You can either give people the power to turn it on and turn it off, to override the automation, and give humans a measure of control.
Or you can make the technology seem soft and fuzzy and harmless, like convince them that everything is going to be okay. Like elevators, you don't even think about them anymore. You just get in them.
But if you think about this, you are walking into a tiny box, and it's controlled by God knows what. You hurtle up through space, 10 stories, 100 stories, and we just get in it.
It's kind of crazy. And in fact, it took a long time and a lot of work from elevator designers to get us to this blissful ignorance we have today.
When elevators were first invented, they were like cars, big things that could kill you. And so, like cars, they needed a driver. There was an operator who would open and close the doors and use ropes or levers to guide the elevator to the proper floor. And like any humans, these elevator operators occasionally made mistakes.
There are accounts in the 19th century of very bad things happening that way.
This is Lee Gray. He wrote The Definitive History of the Passenger Elevator.
People have always hurried in large cities, certainly American cities, in business settings. There were lots of times when, as a businessman, you might say, the elevator's leaving, and you hurry up and you sort of jump the gap into the car and land and off you go just before the operator shuts the door. And if you're athletic, it's all good. If you trip and fall and you're lying half in and half out of the car, the operator's not going to have time to stop. And that ended rather badly.
This was not the image the elevator industry wanted for its new transportation device. So they tried to make it safer. They automated it. They created automatic doors with safety bumpers, automatic stopping, and then a driverless elevator. It was like the Google car of its time.
And people hated it.
People walked in and looked and walked right back out and tried to find someone to say, where's the operator?
They thought something had gone horribly wrong. And what the hell were those buttons with numbers on them?
The elevator industry decided they had to convince people to rethink what an elevator was. It wasn't a gritty, dangerous transportation device. It was an elegant room that magically did your bidding. They put out ads featuring this new driverless elevator.
And in many of those early ads, they showed children pushing the buttons and grandma riding in the elevator car showing, well, how safe this is to put one in your house.
Kids and grandmas. And for the nervous rider, there was a soothing voice that would pipe out of speakers when you walked inside.
This is an automatic elevator. Please press the button for the floor you desire.
And it had other messages like door closing and please do not block the door. And it directed you to the biggest calming device ever invented, a red button that said stop.
It would say you have pulled the emergency stop. If this is not an emergency, please push it back in. If this is an emergency, please use the phone.
But here's what they didn't decide to do. They didn't give any real control to the people inside. There wasn't a special lever in an elevator that someone could grab and take control and change where you were going. There wasn't an emergency override or a way to open the doors in the elevator while you were still moving. It was safer to just let you listen to the music and stare at that red button.
And it took people years to get used to it, but now an elevator feels really safe. So we said there are two ways to get people used to automation, two ways forward for the Google car. The soft and fuzzy way, the elevator way. Just keep reassuring people until they're comfortable.
And then there's a second way. Let the humans take control when they need to. And this is how automation works on airplanes. Most of the time you're in the air on a commercial jet plane, no human is really flying it. It's mostly controlled by computers. But we don't think about this or freak out about it because there are men and women in uniforms sitting up there waiting to take over in an emergency.
The automation in planes is extremely safe. And almost all the time, the plane flies better with this combination of humans and computers. But designers have to think really carefully about how the two work together. Because there are rare times when you might allow humans to make a choice, and they make the wrong one.
And that's what happened to Air France Flight 447. This flight crashed into the Atlantic Ocean in 2009. And it highlights the stakes in getting automation right. This flight was flying from Rio to Paris.
There was a lot of thunderstorm activity, quite typical. Nothing really unusual about that.
William Langovicia is a former pilot who studied this crash and wrote about it in Vanity Fair. He says the main pilot was asleep, and the two co-pilots were at the controls of the plane. But in a real sense, the plane was flying itself.
Suddenly, they lost airspeed indications.
A pressure probe on the outside of the plane had iced over. The automation could no longer tell how fast the plane was going.
And so at this point, the system told the pilots that something was wrong.
And autopilot disconnected with a bell that went off.
But the automated system didn't completely turn itself off. The computer was still there, interpreting and limiting what the pilots did at the controls. But some of the built-in safety features dropped away. The computerized system handed more control back to the human pilots.
But that was no big deal, William says. The plane was still flying straight and steady. It just wasn't getting all the data it normally did. So it gave the human pilots a heads up and then gave them a bit more control over the plane.
It was what happened next that caused the problem.
The co-pilot in the right seat put his hand on the control stick, a little joystick-like thing to his right.
And he pulled it back.
Not just a little. He pulled it 3/4 of the way back.
Why he did that is a major question.
Maybe he was startled or reacting to some turbulence.
Or perhaps he did it because he expected the automated system to smooth out his commands and keep him out of trouble.
The airplane put its nose up and started to soar upward.
This is bad. This can cause a plane to lose speed, to lose lift. And when the automation is running normally, the plane physically will not let this happen. But remember, the plane had handed back control to the people in the cockpit. All the plane could do at this point was warn the pilots.
It said stall, stall, stall.
It would have sounded like this.
Stall, stall. Stall, stall.
The plane knew what was wrong, but the crew didn't, or at least they never figured out how to correct it. Somewhere between the automation and the human pilots was this horrible gap. And in the final minute of the flight, the pilots knew they were going to crash. 4 minutes and 20 seconds after the incident started,
they pancaked into the water at a very high descent rate, and of course it killed everyone instantly.
228 people.
And here's the thing in this case. If the crew had done just one simple thing when all of this had started, they would have been fine.
All the pilots needed to do to avoid this tragedy was nothing.
Not touch a thing.
The airplane was not upset. Had they done nothing, they would have done exactly what they needed to do. Nothing.
The plane would have flown on steadily. The automated system would have re-engaged, and it most likely would have been another unremarkable, forgettable triumph of this machine. If you give people control, they'll use it. And that means sometimes they'll make mistakes, deadly mistakes. But if you take control away, it tends to make us all uneasy, irrationally anxious.
So this is the really high-stakes dilemma facing anyone who wants to make a driverless car. You have to make people comfortable enough to get in the car. You have to give them a sense of control. But then you have to keep them from doing something stupid.
Essentially, Google is asking, should its self-driving car be more like an elevator or more like an airplane? And here's the guy who gets to decide.
I'm Chris Ermson. I lead the self-driving car project here at Google.
When Chris launched this project years ago, the assumption was that drivers would sit and let the Google car drive, but they'd be paying attention to the road, ready to take control when they needed to, just like airline pilots.
And in fact, they let Google employees borrow the self-driving cars to commute home from work.
And there was a little camera inside, so Chris could see if they were really paying attention. But he was amazed by what that camera recorded.
We had one guy who decided to plug his laptop in, right, digging in the back, pulling out the power cord, pulling out the laptop, you know, all while moving down the freeway.
It was pretty easy to imagine the worst case scenario. A driver taking a nap, the Google car is doing fine, the driver wakes up all of a sudden, sees something, and panics, hits the brake, or swerves. So Chris made a call. They had to make the Google car more like an elevator. No steering wheel at all.
If you have a steering wheel there, there's kind of an implicit expectation that you're going to do something with it, right? Why put the steering wheel in the car if you're not supposed to use it? And so, you know, you get to remove a part of the system that you can't design.
Chris is not an idiot. He knows that the idea of a car without a steering wheel is going to freak people out. And so, like the elevator, Google is going the soft and fuzzy route. They're using design to make the car as non-threatening as they can.
All right. It's a tiny little car. You know, from the outside, it looks like someone stuck a bug in a shrinky dink.
I've never heard of it described like that before, but inside it feels pretty spacious.
It's kind of adorable, all round and soft. It has a tiny little black radar mounted to the hood that looks like a button nose. And everything is designed to keep you calm. There is a rear view mirror, although there's no real reason for it. There's a little screen inside that shows you what the car can see. And just like in an elevator in the 50s, there's a reassuring automated voice.
Auto driving.
No elevator music, though, which is probably good.
Now, you're not totally helpless when you're cruising around in this thing. You can use an app on your phone to tell it where to go, and there are a couple buttons inside. You know, there are two for the windows, there's one to pull over, and there is, under a plexiglass shield, the big red button that says stop.
Just like an elevator. Uh-huh. I've never pressed the red button in an elevator, but it's kind of comforting to know it's there. Uh-huh.
In Chris's ideal world, that is all anyone would ever need. Now, we should say that this is the ideal prototype by Google, just a moving box with a big red button. But this still makes some people nervous, specifically California regulators and politicians. So in order to test this car on the roads and highways around Silicon Valley, Google has had to add back a temporary steering wheel and a brake.
Chris hopes that by the time his oldest son turns 16 in 4.5 years, the steering wheel will be a distant memory.
That was a collaboration between Steve Henn from Planet Money and Katie Mingle from 99% Invisible.
I saw you riding round in your brand new automobile. Yes, I saw you riding round, baby, in your brand new automobile. Yes, you were sitting there happy with your handsome driver at the wheel in your brand new automobile.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. So here's a question. When people are actually comfortable enough to take an automated car out for a spin, who exactly is in charge? And if you get into an accident, who is held responsible? Well, earlier this year, the National Highway Transportation Administration decided that, under federal law, the computer in Google's self-driving car could be called the driver. It's a big step towards getting autonomous vehicles like the Google car on the road, and it means that if a driverless car were to get into an accident, hit someone, or run a red light, the computer, not the human, would be at fault. Stephen Wu is a lawyer with the Silicon Valley Law Group. He specializes in subjects like robots and driverless cars. KALW's Angela Johnston asked him to explain the legal and ethical implications of letting the computer take the wheel.
Many of the laws that we have, especially in state vehicle codes and in international law as well as in federal law, focus on the human as the driver. These laws were written, obviously, far before people considered driverless cars to be something realistic. When we have those fully automated vehicles, the manufacturer is going to have to take responsibility for all the things that the quote-unquote driver, the human, used to be responsible for.
So let's say in the future a self-driving car gets in an accident. Will humans, if they're no longer considered the driver, need to buy insurance anymore if they aren't actually at fault?
They will need to buy insurance, but it may be a different kind of insurance. Right now, the insurance industry covers your driving behavior. If you drive carelessly, you might be sued and the insurance company would defend you. You might have somebody hitting your car who is uninsured, and you might have this protection for you yourself. The first kind is called third-party protection. The other kind is called first-party protection. In the future, we might still have first-party protection if somebody steals your car, if somebody damages your car in some way. Mm-hmm. We won't have, if you have a fully automated system, you won't have the kind of third-party protection that is the day-to-day operation, routine operation of the vehicle, because you are not responsible. You are not negligent if something goes wrong with that vehicle because you have no control over it. The manufacturer would then be possibly liable and have its own product liability insurance in case somebody were hurt because of a defect in the car or defect in the software or system or intelligence of the system.
So if the computer is making driving decisions, how will programmers decide whether a car should hit a baby or a senior citizen if it can only pick one or the other?
Right now, the technology is not good enough to have the precision of choosing between the motorcyclist with the helmet or without the helmet, or the older person versus the young girl. Those are not, that kind of hypothetical is not practical today because the sensors don't have the precision to be able to tell what kind of person is standing in the road. So it's not here today, but as the sensors get better, as the technology gets better, manufacturers will have an increasing ability to be precise about what's in the road and what kind of obstacles are in the way of the vehicle and how to steer it. I am now going through the process of writing a paper about the legal aspects of this. Should I steer away from the large group of people in order to avoid hitting all those people, but at the possible cost of running over one person? Should I, as a manufacturer programming that vehicle, actually cause the car to steer towards the one person? That's really the ultimate question. And from a moral perspective, many philosophers would agree that that is the moral decision. It's better to steer away from the 20 at the possible cost of running over the one person. What I am writing this paper about to say is, from a legal perspective, if you are the manufacturer trying to do the quote-unquote right thing from a moral perspective of steering away from the 20 at the cost of running over the one, could you be sued and could you lose the lawsuit if you ran over the one? I think the answer is yes.
Okay, why is that?
Because you are targeting that one person, you are causing harm to that one person, and that one person would have a claim against you for essentially targeting that person and causing the harm, intentionally doing so. If you can imagine the opening statement, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm here to tell you a story of this manufacturer that intentionally steered the car towards my client and ran over my client. This was not something that was an accident. This was something that in the back of their building where they're doing their design process and they were sitting around in these conference tables thinking about what was going to happen, they made a deliberate decision to run over someone in my client's position, and they did it.
And how would it go if it was the opposite, though?
That's part of the irony, which is if the car manufacturer said, okay, we won't steer away from the 20, we'll just allow the car to go straight forward and plow over the 20, you would have 20 claimants who said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, today you're going to hear the story about corporate negligence. They had the ability to steer away from 20 people to save those 20 people. And yes, there would have been this cost, but they made a decision not to take any action.
So there's really no easy answer. How are people going to decide what to do? It seems really impossible, and there's risks either way.
From a legal perspective, there are no legal doctrines, as I see it so far in my research, that would allow you to justify a manufacturer steering away from the 20 at the cost of running over the 1. But what I think is the best answer under the law as currently stated is that you, as a manufacturer, should cause the car to avoid collision at all costs, basically. Try everything you can to avoid a collision. And the way that the hypothetical is written is you have the possibility of running over 21 people instead of 20. If you try to avoid collision, you might make it worse. You might cause more damage. But I think from a legal perspective, it's more defensible than intentionally either running over the 1 or just plowing over the 20. I think from a legal perspective, you're better off doing everything you can to avoid collision, even if you are taking a risk that you might make it worse.
Right, I see. So the moral and legal implications are, even though they relate, they're a bit different in terms
exactly.
of what would work.
Exactly.
Huh. And so I know that, you know, there's 20 versus the 1, but it gets even harder, it seems like, if there's a senior citizen versus a baby, or it's really puts a lot of power, it seems like, in the hands of these manufacturers and these developers.
We don't have the precision in our sensors to be able to make that kind of determination of who's standing in front of us. But let's assume that someday we have that type of precision. Yes, we would be putting a lot of responsibility in the hands of the manufacturers. That's why having people on the staff of manufacturers thinking about ethical issues is absolutely critical.
That was Stephen Wu, a lawyer with the Silicon Valley Law Group. He spoke with KALW's Angela Johnston. So, would you trust a self-driving car? Do you think it's safer than having a human being behind the wheel? Would you get in one? If you ask me, well, I'll let Beyonce speak for me. But that's just me. What do you think? Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff the Great. The line producer was Liz Mack the Terrible. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. If you're a Morning Edition listener here on KALW, you know that local host Joe Burke retired recently from the morning shift, and he's pursuing other interests. One of them is music. Songwriter Judy Jaeger, who you're hearing now, is hosting an evening of original music tomorrow at the Bazaar Cafe in San Francisco. Joe Burke will be performing. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanna Baba. Holding autumn heat pulls out to sea. Night drops in and easily tosses out for those who stay. A star bouquet.
seek our